On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, what do you do when you say, I want to follow the science, but then the science conflicts with the science? If you don't understand what I'm talking about, stick around. You will. We'll get to that one. We are also going to be chatting about what is happening to people. And again, that sounds obscure, obtuse. We are knowing from all kinds of ways that people are crankier, angrier, lashing out more. Why is this happening? What is going on and can we stop it? Oh, we're going to talk about the conservative race that blew open this week. And we're going to go to Beijing and chat about the Olympics before they open up with the history of the games. We're going to be talking about that. Stay with us.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
This week, we saw a study. I don't know if you saw this. I certainly did. Saw a study released from Johns Hopkins University. Got a lot of attention. It concluded, its researchers concluded, that lockdowns did little, if anything, to save lives during the pandemic. Here's a quote from it. Stringency index studies found that lockdowns in Europe and the United States only reduced COVID-19 mortality by 0.2% on average. That's what the researchers wrote. Lockdowns, in other words, were a failed policy that hurt people's mental health and emotional health and social wellness and hurt the economy, but didn't do the thing they were actually supposed to do, which was to save lives. However, a number of other studies have concluded lockdowns are really effective in reducing disease spread and death rates, and they cite their own research that says they're right. Confused? I don't blame you. I am too. My next guest, some time ago, but they were prescient when they wrote this, wrote a piece for The Conversation under the headline, Why Nobody Will Ever Agree on Whether COVID Lockdowns Were Worth It. Their names are Victor Minaldo and Mark Smith. They're two professors from the University of Washington. They join us now. Guys, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you, Ben.
Mark, we have heard endlessly for the past 2 years, the line that we are to follow the science, believe the science. So what are we to do when the science doesn't tell a clear story and the science contradicts the other science? What do we do with that?
You know, I think we should actually do this the same thing, even when the science is clear. Even when the science is clear, science by itself doesn't dictate public policy, and frankly shouldn't dictate public policy, because there are a lot of considerations that come into play. You may be willing to trade off one value against another, but somebody else might not be willing to trade off to make that same trade. So we have to bring a lot of different people together and allow that we are going to have differences, and therefore that's really what politics is. It's the art, hopefully without, you know, overt violent conflict, of resolving disagreements and trying to reach some sort of collective decision. And so I would say that this instance here is just a small scale version of that larger principle.
And Victor, to Mark's point, and I think I agree with him 100% that that's what politics is. But with this whole thing, we were being told this isn't about politics. This is simply about the science. We can believe in the science. But again, you've now got reports on either side of this. It kind of leaves you deciding which science you believe in based on your politics or your philosophies or your leader that you like or your celebrity, whoever endorses it. It kind of leaves you just choosing which science you approve of.
Well, actually, and I agree fully with Mark, big surprise, we both co-author that piece you spoke about, but I agree with Mark about the science being unclear because science can't speak the values, but I do think that it is the wrong conclusion to draw that we should throw the science out, right? We should just be more specific. Now, if you think about that study you referenced, it looks at reduction in mortality rates, right? But it doesn't look at economic welfare effects or the effect on personal freedom and rights or public health in general or political stability or anything like that. So one way to spin the study is to say, actually, you know, 0.2% of 331 million Americans, that's not small fry. That's 662,000 people. So maybe that's worth it. But what Mark challenges us to consider is, well, it depends on what values we're thinking about, right? If it's only about saving lives in the short run from COVID, then the answer is a resounding yes, even though 0.2% seems like a very low number. But if it's thinking about poverty or unemployment or educational deficits in the long run because of the lockdowns, well, the math might come to a different conclusion. The problem that Mark, I think, puts his finger on is that different values will favor different conclusions, right? If we value the future and we value those other things, we might say then it was a resounding failure. I think we have to be very explicit about the values and the trade-offs involved and then look at the consequences of the policies across several different objectives.
So, Mark, in this particular case, so we're talking about lockdowns here, and look, you guys make a ton of sense, not surprisingly, but when we're talking about lockdowns, was the sales pitch for lockdowns not this will save lives? And even then, you get to what Victor just said, well, which lives, like, what are you talking about? Are you talking purely about from COVID? Are you talking about people who have lost the ability to get a surgery because surgery clinics are shut down or whatever else? I mean, again, the whole thing becomes exceedingly complex.
Yeah, I totally agree with that point. I would add things like lockdowns and social distancing and isolation more generally lead to more time at home, which has led a lot of people to gain weight. Obesity, ironically, is one of the contributing factors to COVID itself. It's led people to consume more alcohol. Alcohol contributes to a lot of...
We've read that, ailments. Yep.
And on a one-to-one basis, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Another angle on this, which is really hard to incorporate into a study, but I think has to be part of the discussion, at least certainly retrospectively. The lockdowns, it created a lot of ill will among parts of the population, and got kind of the public health experts off to the wrong foot among certain parts of the population. Again, more so, I think, in the U.S. than in Canada, but you all are seeing that now as well.
Oh, no, we've got it. Oh, we've got it.
Yeah, you got your fair share, too. Well, a lot of the people who were vaccine resistors, maybe they would have gotten vaccinated if they had more confidence in the public health community. And if vaccines are really the single best tool to fight COVID, which I think the science on that really is clear, that your odds of hospitalization and death are something like 1/20th on a case controlled basis if you're vaccinated and boosted as opposed to not. So if a ton of people got alienated from public health messaging through the lockdowns, that leads them later to not get vaccinated. And then we see now high death tolls, and it's overwhelmingly now from the non-vaccinated population. The lockdowns might have had this indirect way where they actually maybe caused deaths through this other channel by undermining the credibility of the whole public health messaging.
All right. So, Mark, we only have a minute or so left here, but all of what we're talking about brings us to the headline and to what you guys have written, why nobody will ever agree on whether COVID lockdowns were worth it. Is that a bad thing? I mean, do we need to have unanimity of thought on this, or is it okay that we disagree on this stuff?
Yeah, let me have Victor jump in on that one.
Okay.
I actually think I'm going to, play the stereotypical academic. Both things are true in a sense, okay? It's okay to disagree if we acknowledge Mark's fundamental point about values and the trade-offs between them and the fact that they're irreconcilable sometimes. But it's not okay to disagree, I think, if we start to forget about what science can do, and science can answer very specific questions. So I do think distorting or abusing science to have it cover things beyond its scope is a mistake. It creates a lack of credibility or trust or legitimacy, as Mark said. But I think it's okay to say, here's what we know about what science has told us. And then we can disagree about values and not mix them together. I think that's where there's danger. And let me say one final thing on that point.
Please.
I worry a lot about the fact that we're having a huge debate right now about risk preferences and our appetite for risk. And it's getting clouded in the language of science. We're figuring out the social contract around risk in the aftermath of COVID and what are acceptable risks or not. And it seems like we're getting wrapped around the axle in ways that have nothing to do with science and more to do about, well, how should we organize society when people disagree on what risks are tolerable or what risks are worth it. I don't know if Mark wants to speak to this. He's thought about this a bit as well.
Sure. Yeah, Mark, quickly, because we got about 20 seconds. So sorry to cut you short, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think both Victor and I would agree on this point that we have to distinguish between facts and values. Science, when it's done well, contributes to facts. But facts alone don't dictate public policy decisions because those are inherently involve a mix of different considerations, trade-offs of various kinds, the future versus the present, people's variation on risk preferences, as Victor was getting at. So I think our final takeaway would be it's just public policy is a complicated beast. We should allow that, recognize that, embrace that.
That is Mark A. Smith and Victor Minaldo from the University of Washington, political science professors. Guys, really appreciate the time. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes today.
Sure thing. Glad to do so.
Yeah, thank you. That was fun.
You can read their piece. It's on The Conversation. It's a great website, by the way. Lots of thought-provoking stuff there. The Conversation, why nobody will ever agree on whether COVID lockdowns were worth it.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Came across a really interesting piece that I found online. And when I saw who had written this, I said, oh, we got to get him on. Because we had this guy on maybe a couple of years ago talking about daylight savings time and how it screws up your brain. And he was fantastic. And then when I saw him write a piece in Psychology Today under the headline, burnout is causing growing hostility towards others. People are on a short fuse, increasingly prickly and thoughtlessly lashing out, which I find it hard to believe there's anyone out there listening who would say, oh, no, I completely disagree with that. I think society is in a far better place today than it was a couple of years ago. We're all much, much happier than we were. Yeah, there's nobody is going to say that. I want to bring in Dr. Richard Sitowick. He is a professor of neurology at George Washington University. He's a prolific author. And as I say, he's been on this show before, and we're thrilled to have him back because he was fantastic. Dr. Sitowick, thank you for doing this.
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back here.
There is, I want to start here because there is a great line in the piece you wrote as a great, I think, great jumping off point. Let me read it to you, although you wrote it, so you know this. Broken free from conventional moorings, it is easy to drift into altercations and reflexive violence without thinking through the consequences. What are the conventional moorings that in these days that we have drifted away from?
Well, the typical moorings of civility. To people, you process what they say, you give them the benefit of the doubt, and today that hardly exists. Somebody doesn't agree with you; they're evil. You vilify them, and that's what we have today.
Why? What is different? I mean, I know that COVID is on.
The right and the left can't even talk to one another because they aren't listening to one another.
Is that the key?
They don't want to listen to one another.
Is that the key that we're not listening, do you think?
Oh, I think that's a big aspect of it is that somebody says, "Oh, I'm right, I'm left, I'm this." And we immediately go into the attack mode that, oh, well, if you don't think like I do, then you're my enemy, and so I'm going to destroy you. Yes, we don't listen to one another. I think that's a big issue.
So when I read this piece, and as I was introducing you there, look, I don't believe that anybody listening right now, doctor, is going to say, no, I think that we're doing a much better job at getting along these days. Like, no one is going to think that.
We all
recognize what's going on here. So if we know this is happening, and everyone listening is nodding their head saying, yeah, I see that. If we know this is happening, why is it still happening rather than it being corrected because we are humans who go, oh, I see the problem, let me fix that?
Because we can't get out of our typical modes of thinking. We can't get beyond, oh, you disagree with me, therefore I hate you, to, oh, you disagree with me, let me understand why you disagree with me. So we can't get past the emotion to asking, how can I understand why you differ with me? I mean, take vaccines. I mean, scientifically oriented people think, how can anybody think that vaccines are not the most wonderful thing? I mean, vaccines are the greatest invention in human health in the past two centuries. So how can anybody think that? But we have to get past that question of how can anybody think that to why does anybody think that? And to understand why they think that way, as opposed to how could they be so stupid?
Which probably doesn't seem like a way to win friends and influence people and get them to get vaccinated if, in fact, you're just calling them an idiot.
Exactly. You can't, you're browbeating people into agreeing with you is not the way to go.
So is this, do you believe that this is happening, that it's not a coincidence that it's during the pandemic when we've had lockdowns and everything else? Or do you think this is, pandemic or not, this was going to happen because society has been moving this way?
Well, I think one of the issues that's happened during the pandemic is that we have exhausted our resiliency. You know, the resilience is the ability to cope with all sorts of terrible things that happens to us and manage and get through it. And our resilience has just become exhausted. And so in the face of that, we're left with this ad hoc hectoring.
Is there also a part of this, and this may be a crazy idea, I don't know if there's anything to this, but we have spent so much time alone in this because, again, of lockdowns and everything else. Do we forget how to be human beings who deal with other human beings? Do we need practice to do that?
Exactly. I mean, this is the third year of the pandemic. We have been isolated. I mean, speaking for myself, I can count on one hand the people that I have spoken to in person in the past year. So, yes, we are terribly alone. We are isolated. We have not been able to sort of, like, I mean, humans are social beings. I mean, the Greeks said it first. We are a political animal, meaning that not that we're political in our sense, but that we live in a polis, a city state of other individuals, and we have been disconnected from other individuals, from our families and our friends. I mean, you see it in people, you know, this past year when everybody's been flying out for Christmas and Thanksgiving, that they're dying to be with their families. And I think that shows that how much people want to connect with one another. And we have not been able to connect with one another.
There is one other thing, and we have time for one other thing. I wish we could talk a lot more, but there's one other thing here, and that is you point out in the piece you wrote again in Psychology Today, and I'll give the headline again in just a minute for people who want to look it up. And that is, you know, normally, even if you were inclined to act like an idiot or to be aggressive towards someone, there's a little voice in the back of your head that says, if I do this, I could get myself in an awful lot of trouble. Even that seems to, for some people, for maybe a lot of people, seems to be going away. And despite the risk that you could find yourself on a video camera doing something, or someone could identify you or whatever, there's a bunch of people who, it seems now, don't even mind that. What's happened with that? Why has that filter gone away?
Yes, exactly right. The filter has gone. Is that people think, oh, I could go to prison. Forget that. I'm going to shoot this guy. We have totally lost that buffer.
Why?
And whether that's due to our what we've gone through in the past 3 years of this pandemic, it's hard to say, but it's gone nonetheless.
It is a fascinating piece. I would encourage people to go look it up when they get a minute online. It's in Psychology Today. The headline is, "Burnout is causing growing hostility towards others. People are on a short fuse, increasingly prickly, and thoughtlessly lashing out. It is worth a read, if only so you don't become that person," as a little self-reflection, written by Dr. Richard Cytowick. Really appreciate the time today. Thank you for doing this.
A short fuse indeed. Thank you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Well, if you are Aaron O'Toole, as I say, today is probably not a day you're going to write too much in your diary about. It's probably a better day to forget. It's the knives were out for the leader of the Conservative Party today from his caucus, and he was voted out. And it wasn't even close. I mean, he lost a confidence vote, a leadership vote, rather handily. And so now it is the competition is on to see who is going to replace Aaron O'Toole. I want to bring in Kate Harrison. She's a vice president with Summit Strategies to chat about this. And before we get to that, I must say, Kate, I don't know what your feelings are on Aaron O'Toole, but in your profile picture on your company's website, you are wearing a Buffalo Bills hat. So I don't know, this has got to have been a tough few weeks going through all this stuff.
Yeah, I can only take so much loss in my life, Scott. I got to be honest, the Bills loss was maybe more crushing for me than today. But things can only go up from here. It's early in the year, right? So things can only improve.
And there's always next year. I think isn't that the Buffalo Bills motto?
Yeah. I think I'm not a Leafs fan. Otherwise, I'd be 3-for-3.
You know, this is not what we're going to talk about, but, you know, if you are a sports fan in Southern Ontario generally, your skin is as thick as a rhino right now, because the Jays, you know, it's been a long time, and the Leafs, I don't know if you heard this week we passed the 20,000 day mark since the Leafs won the Stanley Cup, which is astonishing. And of course the, you know, Raptors won. Okay. That was good. And, the Ticats don't ever win, and the Bills don't win, and the Sabres are, if you're around here. Anyway, let's move on to happier things. The complete evisceration of a political leader. Comparatively, right. That may be happier. Look, I wasn't surprised at all today that Aaron O'Toole was knocked off his pedestal, because, I mean, when they took it to this point, you kind of thought they're not going to go here unless there's a pretty good chance that he's gone. And even if they hadn't won, if it had been close to 50%, there's no way he could have kept leading with half his caucus against him. But I was surprised, Kate, I was surprised at how convincing the vote was.
Yeah, and I mean, if there's a silver lining to take away from it, because a lot of the story will be about, you know, the Conservatives are divided, division, et cetera. This is quite decisive. And I am a little bit surprised that O'Toole's people let it get to that point, to have the vote be that certain against him and face that vote I'm sure they could go back in time and change that and fix that and have it not get to that point. So clearly, they weren't really reading the tea leaves right on where his support in caucus was. And I think that might actually be, a consistent theme in terms of, O'Toole's downfall, over the last few weeks or months or however long you think it may have gone on for, is I think that he has had a difficult time reading the room and tapping into a moment and a feeling that a lot of conservatives have right now, of course, you know, tied to COVID fatigue and other things. But I think that if timing is everything in politics, this is not his time, and he wasn't able to connect himself to the way a lot of people are thinking and feeling right now in the party and in the movement.
Do you think that, what word would you attach to this? Because, I mean, you could look at this and say, okay, there was anger because of the way they voted, or is it frustration, or is it, what word would you attach to your interpretation of what this means?
I think it's an outcome of frustration, but I also think that there's I think it's really driving at an attempt to be relevant and current, and conservatives struggle with that. From a brand perspective and reputationally, in terms of tying themselves and their beliefs and their values to current political events and current affairs. A lot of Canadians, if you ask them what they think about conservatives and conservatism, it's not that it's with the times and contemporary. It's quite the opposite, right? So I think that with so much having changed in the last 18, 24 months, seeing other parts of the world change when it comes to things like COVID restrictions, lots of jurisdictions opening up, doing away with mandates, doing away with passports, travel restrictions and other things, a lot of conservatives are getting some FOMO and looking around and saying, well, what are we not doing that we can't encourage that same kind of that reaction and approach? Now, they're not in government, but you do see other conservatives, big C conservatives elsewhere, standing up on principle and saying lockdowns are bad. And we've been there. We know that there are consequences for public health that go beyond even that of the COVID pandemic itself, longer term consequences, not just economic. So I think a lot of conservatives were, again, having that realization that there was a moment here that could be tapped into and that the current leader was missing the mark.
And that's, you know, that's kind of what I wonder. I mean, the knock against him has been, and we've been hearing this over and over and over, the knock is that he was incapable of finding a position and sticking to it, that he was vacillating and, you know, each day there would be a new position on something. But I really do wonder if that was really it, or was it truly more the fact that he lost to a guy in the last election that most people thought was really vulnerable and you still didn't win this thing. And so it's not so much that we care that you change your position a bit. We care that you didn't win. And that is your greatest sin as the leader.
Well, yeah, that certainly those that were already, I'll say, predisposed to being against O'Toole would point to the fact that on paper, there were very few things to be pleased about at the last election campaign. I have a slightly different view on this, and I'm sure other conservatives do, which is that we did improve our margin in areas that we need to win in the 905, in places like Hamilton, where there needs to be more of a showing from conservatives. I think that considering conservatives were supposed to be decimated in the last campaign, again, Justin Trudeau called it at the best possible time for himself, and the fact that they held them to a minority, I think, is something to be pleased about. What happened between the loss and now is, I think, why we're here today. And it would be a mistake to say that the trucker convoy alone is what led to this, or the election loss alone is what led to this, but it's the intervening period. And what I would suggest is a lack of extending an olive branch to people that maybe O'Toole doesn't always agree with, and then showing some pretty demonstrable and concrete action in the past 5 months to revisit some policies in a way that is thoughtful, as opposed to at the 11th hour when your leadership is on the line. So I think that there was more that could have been done in the interim period. Maybe it was taking a harder line on mandates. Maybe it was taking a harder line on, frankly, what some of the provinces have been doing as far as restrictions are concerned, and putting elbows up a little bit in terms of, you know, challenging what conservative premiers are doing. But that didn't happen. So that led to the convoy effectively being a tinderbox for all of that frustration to pent up. And it's now been a pretty major factor in O'Toole's loss.
Well, and again, you know, you can agree or disagree, and I'm happy to hear where you stand on this one. But I also look and I think, you know, like, conservatives, by and large, despise Justin Trudeau. I mean, there is no love for Justin Trudeau. And every time he comes out and makes a comment that if you, you know, you're on the fringe if you disagree, or you're a misogynist or a sexist, it is like scraping fingernails down a chalkboard. And the fact that he was not beaten, I think that, again, that goes back. Aaron O'Toole is seen as the guy who should have beaten him and stopped him and didn't. And there wasn't much sign that he was going to next time. So we got to get rid of this guy.
Yeah. And I think that conservatives kind of consistently let their dislike of Justin Trudeau get the better of what they think is a realistic electoral opportunity. Justin Trudeau is Teflon. Very little sticks to him. The guy wore blackface. He still continues to get in, elected into office, and it's conservatives that are the ones that are called racist. So at some point, conservatives need to kind of realize that, you know, Justin Trudeau still has a likability factor with the public. Now, it's diminishing returns every time. So there's that to look forward to, and I think conservatives have helped contribute to that. What Justin Trudeau does have is some degree of relatability and authenticity. And I think that that's where conservatives are putting a lot of stock in their leadership to generate some of these same feelings. So I don't think this is so much for conservatives about changing the channel as it is about turning up the volume a little bit and approaching things with a bit of a sharper tone, a sharper edge, a little bit more clearly communicating their positions, rather than a wholesale, you know, burn the party down and start from scratch. I think that this is more about shaking it up with a change in tone.
Okay, so what is that tone? Because you've got a whole bunch of people who apparently, we don't know, but apparently are interested. And do you go then with the soft, gentle, warm, welcoming bosom of the party that, you know, everyone's, or do you get someone like Pierre Poilievre who just is, you know, is it can tear you down in a debate and can win a debate? Which side is going to win for the Conservatives?
Yeah, I mean, what wins in a leadership is not necessarily what will win in a general election. And I think that
Absolutely.
That's something to think about, right? I suspect that the fire-breathing, impassioned conservatism is going to get a lot of attention in the leadership race. But I think for longer-term success, yes, of course, it's good to have great sound bites and be good in a media scrum and, of course, in the House of Commons and when you're in a debate. But being able to tie together a narrative that speaks to how people are feeling and, frankly, looking at pocketbook issues, I think it's just going to be really, really important for whoever the next leader is. Time and again, cost of living, inflation, housing affordability, these are issues that come up that people care about, they're talking about quite a bit. We need to make sure that the next leader is able to speak and be solutions oriented, not just blame the government in what their proposals are. So I think that it will be, I think that it will be a impassioned race when the time comes. I struggle to see it being coronation because conservatives don't like those too much. But I think that we always kind of see a leveling out after the leadership campaign in terms of tone and approach. And I think that really for the success, it's more about tapping into the emotion people are feeling right now. And it's a lot of fatigue and it's a lot of helplessness and hopelessness about their personal circumstances and situations. So the leader needs to be able to tap in and provide more of an optimistic outlook.
I think you just, I really believe you just nailed it for them though, because when you said the, you know, the economy and finances and all the rest, like you can get, it seems to me the Conservatives get bogged down and tripped up in a lot of different issues, but the one place where they can make a mark, we know that people are struggling with the economy. We know the debt is growing. We know interest rates are going up. We know that we could be facing some tough times going forward. And if you can, whoever becomes the leader, if you can establish your party, make the narrative, we are the party that is going to look after your money properly. We're the party that's not going to squander tax dollars. We're the party that's in better shape to try and handle the problems that you're going to face at your, that to me is the winning strategy, not to get all caught up in all the other stuff that they kind of get stuck in sometimes.
Yeah. And I mean, conservatives always have to be ready for those attacks on mainly divisive social issues from their opponents. But I'm not sure that the electorate, it really wants to get bogged down in those debates, Scott. I think to your exact point, people are worried about their personal finances. And I think really an issue that conservatives have played a lot of defense on in the past that they need to start really being more proactive about is housing. So much stems from the ability to put a roof over your head. Of course, people's houses are their lifetime savings in most cases. We need to get really serious about how we're going to address supply. And I think that a lot of affordability issues stem from that. And conservatives need to come to the table with a really sharp, coherent plan about what they're going to do to fix supply and how they're going to help first-time buyers get into the market. Because what we have happening in regions like Hamilton, Ottawa, elsewhere, it's just not sustainable.
And I don't think that it's smart for the Conservatives, and honestly, and I think they did this a bit in the last election, I don't think it's smart to try and do the economy thing as just part of your story when it comes to election time. You have had to have set the table and told this story leading up to it, so you've become known for that. And, you know, doing that now, assuming that, and look, nobody hopes that we're going to be in economic difficulties in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years or whatever the election is called, but if you've consistently told this story over and over and over, maybe that sticks as what you're known for, as opposed to waiting.
And conservatives are often accused of having a secret agenda. And so to put that to rest, what the O'Toole team did was put out a very, very detailed platform early on in the campaign. And I think the right strategy is absolutely to release it early, not leave any ambiguity about where you stood. But a huge policy document isn't what most voters are reading and consuming every day, and it can lend itself to too many messages happening at the same time. So I think you've got to stick to your big three priorities, if that's what it is. It's hard not to see the economy being interlaced and woven around all three. But yeah, absolutely get ahead of that issue as early as possible. And I think to your point about when the next election might be, Justin Trudeau has played his unnecessary election card. I don't necessarily think that there's another one for him to play. The Conservatives need to be ready fast. We're in a minority government. The Trudeau might try his hand again. Who knows? So this leadership race really should not be a long and drawn out affair. I think that they should try to make it as tidy as possible and get somebody new in, maybe even by the summer, give them time to socialize over the summer months and hit the ground running in the fall.
Well, remember, Prime Minister Trudeau, back in the election campaign, I think it was the French language debate, said that if we don't win a majority, we could be back to the polls in 18 months. Now, I don't know if he meant it, but that was said. And so, you know, there's a time frame to consider for, yeah, why you would want to do this relatively quickly. All right, we just have a minute or so left here. And Kate, there are a lot of interesting names, and we'll hear lots of talk about them going ahead in the next few weeks. One of the ones that I've already read this today, and I find this really interesting. I think she is, I don't know her personally. I don't know a whole lot about her, honestly, Leslyn Lewis. But I've already heard people say, look, the Conservatives could seriously undermine so much of the social stuff that liberals always throw at them if they were to have a leader who was a Black woman. And, you know, and that may be true. On the other hand, that seems like, now, I'm not saying she's not going to win, and I'm not saying she couldn't be fantastic if she did. I don't know.
Right.
But playing that sort of woke, or whatever word you want to use, that sounds sort of antithetical. If she wins, great, because she's the best. But the idea of just choosing someone because they look a certain way sounds, it might win some votes, but it sounds opposite of what the Conservatives generally want to do.
Yeah, it's the kind of crass tokenism, frankly, that Conservatives accuse Liberals of very often, right? Because we have a gender-neutral cabinet, we're automatically capital F feminist. Well, look at the way Justin Trudeau treats his female cabinet ministers. So I think that as a value proposition to Conservative voters, that argument would probably fall on deaf ears. I think that there's a lot to back up Leslyn Lewis's candidacy outside of her skin color and her gender. I think that she, if she enters the race, will bring, as she did last time, a bit of a thoughtful, at that point it was an outsider perspective. She's been in caucus now. Maybe some of her views on things have changed as a result of that. But, you know, she would be a formidable contender, certainly. But I think that Conservatives will be extremely reluctant to necessarily park their votes with her for
just for that, for appearance.
Gender. Exactly.
Right. Before we go, who, and again, we've been, what, 5 hours since this happened, whatever it was?
Body's still warm. The body is still warm.
So. Unfortunately. Who do you think is the favorite right now? Who would you put your money on if you had to put something down right now?
It's hard not to see Pierre Poilievre as a front runner in this. You know, there was a lot of speculation that he was going to go for this last time. And he said he wasn't doing that because of having had a young kid. Now he's just had a second child recently. So the timing may still not be right for him for that reason. Who knows? But if the Conservatives are looking for a communicator that can kind of turn the volume up on their issues, there's no doubt that Pierre Poilievre is very good at doing that. So I think that he will be a formidable contender. However, I don't think that it's going to be a coronation. I think that we'll probably be seeing somebody to the right of him, probably somebody to the left, maybe somebody from the West. There was nobody from the West last time that decided to put their hat in the ring. What does Michelle Rempel-Garner, for example, decide to be another name that comes up quite a bit? So I'm really curious to see how it develops, but I think that we will be in for a real contest because Conservatives will expect that.
Kate Harrison from Summit Strategies. I always love having you on. Thanks for taking time today.
Thanks so much, Scott. Have a good one.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
If you wake up bright and early, I mean bright and early, like 6:30 a.m. early on Friday, you will be able to see the opening ceremonies from the Olympics in Beijing. However, the athletes, by and large, are all there now. Games, competition is already getting underway, even ahead of the opening ceremonies. And Philip Barker is already there. Philip is not just a member of the International Society of Olympic Historians, which we'll get to that part of his credentials in a second. Also a writer for InsideTheGames.biz, where the other day he posted a great article about the history of the Winter Games. Philip is now joining us from the main press center in Beijing. Philip, thanks for doing this today. Really appreciate it.
Ni hao, as we say in China.
Good morning.
That is the greeting people say when they come into the press center, because all the Chinese volunteers are here. And the other greeting is, of course, Happy New Year, because it is Chinese New Year at the moment. We've moved from the year of the ox to the year of the tiger. Yesterday, we had the launch of the domestic part of the Olympic torch relay here. It's only 3 days, so it's nothing like the one that they had in Calgary in 1988 or in Vancouver in 2010. It's a really short one. It's almost as short as the shortest of all the relays, which was 70 years ago in Oslo when they started the whole thing, only a couple of days. So it's going to all the centers of this Olympic Games, but over the next 2 days, we're expecting International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach to carry the torch, and also officials of the United Nations. And then on the final evening, of course, the cauldron will be lit in the Bird's Nest Stadium, which is not more than about a kilometer away from where I am now. It won't be using the old cauldron from 2008, though, because that stands outside. You might remember that Leaning, the gymnast, soared through the air to light the cauldron about 100 feet above the ground.
Right.
That will not be happening, but it's going to be something rather special, we're told.
Philip, tell me this. We don't have time to go into everything I'd like to go into, but one of the main questions that people have had, and one of the main discussion points that has been going on about what you as a journalist, what people there are able to say about what is going on. If I was to ask you some questions about Beijing or about China or about the Olympics and what they're doing there, do you feel comfortable that you, I'm not going to right now, but do you feel comfortable you could answer even if it was not necessarily complimentary? Is that feeling, or is there a feeling that I better not say anything bad about this?
I'm a British journalist, so we're renowned for being fearless. And yes, there is a degree of, skepticism about some of the claims in China. There are problems. There is censorship here. You have to get a special network on your computer to get the internet in your hotel. And I have seen censorship when stories about China are being shown on the television. Suddenly it goes to fuzz. So that is something that happens. And clearly there are people in some minorities who feel persecuted. The Chinese government say that they're not doing it, and there's a counter thing. So there is movement on that score. And there are misgivings about having the games here. What I would say, though, is that we have thousands of volunteers around. And one of the things about the Olympics, Jesse Owens said it in Montreal in 1976, the Olympic Games are about breaking bread with the world and exchanging views and exchanging contacts and coming together, which is part of the Olympic motto now. And that has been very important. The enthusiasm of the youngsters here, that isn't forced. You can tell when people are going through the motions, and it's a genuine human reaction. I'll give you an example. We have a bubble-to-bubble system here. We're not allowed to walk out on the streets. We have to catch the bus from the hotel into the Olympic installations as part of COVID precautions. In Japan, the bus would go on the dot, whether you were running for it or not. Here in China, the volunteer will be running out, stopping the bus, say, hang on, we've got some more people to get on. That human quality. And I found that so far. I'm not the most, I'm a little bit tardy occasionally, so I do need to run for a bus. And they've been helping out, and you know, basically trying to do whatever they can to make this work.
Well, listen, we will, hopefully you and I will be able to, and we're not done yet, but hopefully you and I will be able to catch up in the next few days, sometime in the middle of the Olympics, to find out about how the games are going. But I do want to take the few minutes that we do have here, because your piece that you wrote for InsideTheGames.biz, it was really interesting. It was really well done. And it's something I hadn't thought a whole lot about, which was, you know, the Winter Olympics are not as, they don't have the history that the Summer Olympics do. And take a second or two and explain where these things came from. Where did the idea for a Winter Olympics even come from?
It came from the people like Canada, France, Switzerland, the people who played ice and snow sports. The Nordic countries were very anti the Winter Olympics because they had their own Nordic Games and they didn't want their thunder to be stolen. We did have skating in London in 1908. And in fact, skating was included on the International Olympic Committee's prospectus when they were first drawing everything up in 1894 to revive the modern Olympics as one of the sports that was desirable. But eventually, it was the Paris was good stage 1924, and the French lobbied hard for an International Sports Week. And the official title was International Sports Week under the higher patronage of the International Olympic Committee and all the local authorities. And that's not even the longest part of the name, I tell you. So it's a good job they came up with a tagline, Winter Olympics. They are separate from the Summer Olympics in sequence. They have completely different numbering. They used to happen in the same year, and sometimes the same country will stage Summer and Winter Olympics. Imagine the cost of that now. But, you know, they've gone on. We've seen in Canada probably raised the games to a new level in 1988 in Calgary and then in Vancouver in 2010. They showed that they absolutely adore the Olympics. And I could see that last night because I was with the flag bearers when they were announced, Charles Amelin and Marie-Philippe Poulin. They were proudly standing in front of the Maple Leaf flag, conducting their conference in impeccable English and impeccable French, which is something that not everybody can do. And they're clearly looking forward to these games. They're in action. I think the Canadian ice hockey team are playing the Swiss tonight.
Yes, they are. Beijing.
I'm going to leave you to sort out the actual times that you can view this because I still haven't got my clock from British summertime or even Greenwich Mean Time to Chinese time. So
it'll be 11:10 p.m. for those who want to watch. 11:10 p.m. our time here is apparently when. Now again, forgive me if that turns out to be wrong, but that's what I'm told. It's got Eastern time beside it, so I'm going to go with that one and say that it's right. Philip, one of the things though, when you go back to the early days, and there's some hilarious things with the early days of Winter Olympics. Is it right that in the first Winter Olympics they had rugby and football?
They had rugby in 1900. There were three teams, one of them from England called Moseley, and they traveled overnight and had to play their game the very same day. Eintracht Frankfurt and Paris eventually won. Coubertin was a rugby referee, by the way. He refereed the Rugby Cup final in France one year, and they had it in 1908 in London. Australia played against Cornwall, who were the county champions. And this
in
was
the Winter Olympics?
They were winter sports in 1908. Wow. Winter sports included ice skating, football, hockey, and rugby football. football by what you might understand as soccer. And what the problem was with rugby, you kick for touch, and the ball goes into touch. Unfortunately, the rugby pitch had a swimming pool alongside, and therefore every time the ball went in, you can imagine how slippery it was for the players to handle. And this is the Cornish excuse for losing 32-3 to the Australians. In 1920, the Americans came, and the Americans were actually the reigning champions. They still are at 15 aside rugby. Obviously, we've got sevens now, which Fiji rule the roost in the men's game and the Aussies in the women's game. But yes, they had rugby. They also had a gold medal in the first Winter Olympics for mountain climbing. And this was the best climb over the previous 4 years. And it went to an Everest exhibition from Great Britain. Quite poignantly, it was George Mallory who died on the slopes a few months later, a very famous expedition. And in 2012, they actually took a gold medal from London up to the top of Everest, just as a symbolic gesture to those guys who had died during the 1924 expedition. So but mountaineering, Coubertin really wanted a mountaineering prize. They did it throughout the years before the Second World War, and then unfortunately it's gone. But now, of course, we've got climbing in the Olympics. So we have at least got the spirit of the climbers, if not the mountains.
Yeah, and you now actually have proof that they got to the top as opposed to, you know, taking your word for it.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, funny enough, Beijing in 2008 took their torch up to the top of Mount Everest. So, you know, there's a strong connection with climbing anyway. But the wall climbing that we see in the Olympics, it was in for the first time in Tokyo last time, and it was a hit, and people loved it. So hopefully it will endure. We've got Schemo in Cortina d'Ampezzo, which is the next Winter Olympics in 2026. You know, a lot of these things come in the Youth Olympics and then are developed and then sure. come in the Summer Games, so, you know, Summer or Winter Games. And it really works sometimes to use that as a sort of little test tube, as it were, or experimental phase. And you see how it works with the youngsters. And then, of course, they go on. And sometimes you see a champion from the younger players going through to actually compete in the Olympics as well. And when they win a medal, it's absolutely magical.
It is. It is. Philip, we only have a minute left here. And I got to say also, I found after reading your piece, I started looking around and there's a site that has it listed 25 photos of the first Winter Olympics. And I got to say, one of the most stunning things is watching the bobsledders. Not only are the bobsleds almost on, they look like go-karts more than bobsleds, but nobody wearing helmets racing down the track. Times have changed.
Times have certainly changed. That was certainly the case with speed skating, even into the 50s and 60s. It was only when you got people like Carl Schranz and Jean-Claude Killy and the skin sight bodysuits in the 1960s. Before that, they raced down in 1952. They were winning gold medals in downhill skiing, and they weren't wearing helmets. They had goggles on, mine, but not helmets. So but thank goodness there's a little bit more consciousness about safety now.
Yes, very much. Listen, we can't. I wish we had a lot more time, but Philip Barker, you can read him in InsideTheGames.biz. Again, you can find more about him at the International Society of Olympic Historians. Philip, I sincerely appreciate you taking some time today. I know how busy it is for you. And hopefully, as I say, sometime over the next couple of weeks, we may be able to catch up again. But I really appreciate you taking the time today. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. We've got some deadlines to meet, but we've got 2 days, and tomorrow night, I can't wait for the opening ceremony.
Philip Barker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.